Now let's go to your topic, and that is digestion and its connection to the mind, memory, and food. Now, by the way, Dr. DeBay is a certified clinical nutritionist and a sports chiropractor, and he practices at the Center for Progressive Medicine in Manhattan. Digestive problems can slowly erode health and eventually manifest in more serious conditions. Why don't you go through the different symptoms and their causes of our digestive dilemmas? Because some people have it, don't even recognize that their symptoms are a problem.
Okay, that's true. Some people have problems with digestion, and it manifests in such a way that they never make the connection. The common digestive symptoms that are clearly connected to what's going on in the gastrointestinal tract include heartburn, nausea, belching, bloating, cramping, flatulence, constipation, and diarrhea. Then there's a myriad of other symptoms that are also connected to what's going on in the gastrointestinal tract. These include headaches, fatigue, joint and muscle pains, depression, difficulty concentrating, female hair loss, weak fingernails, skin problems. Virtually any symptom, in my opinion, can be related to what's going on in the gastrointestinal tract. And autoimmune diseases and virtually every degenerative disease can be connected to malfunction within the gastrointestinal tract. Now, the causes of gastrointestinal dysfunction include stress, food sensitivities, maldigestion or lack of digestive secretions. For example, if we don't produce enough hydrochloric acid within the stomach, this can result in belching, bloating, fullness for extended times after eating, flatulence immediately after eating, constipation, in some cases diarrhea, and a myriad of other symptoms from anemia to osteoporosis. All this can be due to lack of just one digestive secretion. And the production of hydrochloric acid seems to fall with age, and it's estimated that about half of people over age 65 don't produce enough hydrochloric acid. And then, of course, if we're lacking any of the other digestive secretions, this also impairs the gastrointestinal function. Medications are another problem. If we take antibiotics, it kills off the beneficial bacteria along with the toxic organisms. Normally, within the intestinal tract, there's on the order of 400 different species of bacteria, and there's yeast, and in a healthy state, they will live in balance. They will have their own niche, and everything's in balance, and this produces a good effect on our overall health. But when we take antibiotics, or even consume food that contains traces of antibiotics, this is enough to upset the balance of bacteria within the intestinal tract. Another cause of gastrointestinal problems is the presence of toxic parasites, yeast, and bacteria that shouldn't be there in the first place. And many of these organisms are opportunistic, and they take over when there's immune dysfunction, weakened immune system, or lack of the beneficial strains of bacteria.
All right. What can be done to eradicate toxic organisms?
Medication can be used, and so can natural compounds. Some of the natural compounds, for example, for parasites would include artemisia. For bacteria, golden seal is often effective. For yeast overgrowth, caprylic acid is often a good choice. One of the laboratories I use for analyzing the digestive function and the presence of different organisms within the intestinal tract performs a sensitivity test. What this is when a toxic organism is found, let's say a yeast, it is cultured in different dishes, and to those dishes, different medications and natural compounds are added. And in this way, the laboratory gives me a report to let me know which compounds are most effective in eradicating that organism. So that's often very helpful. Then in addition to the compounds already mentioned, I like to use a formula that contains some more physiologic compounds. A formula I use called Probioplex Intensive Care contains something called lactoferrin. Lactoferrin is a protein made by the body naturally, and this protein sequesters iron. And the effect this has is it starves toxic bacteria. The beneficial bacteria are not dependent upon iron, but the toxic bacteria are. So lactoferrin in effect, starves the toxic bacteria. Another ingredient of this formulation is an enzyme called lactoperoxidase, and that's also naturally occurring within the gastrointestinal tract. Lactoperoxidase has the effect of actually drilling holes in the bacteria and helps to kill them off in this way. Another ingredient in this formulation is globulin protein from whey, which mimics our own secretory IgA. Secretory IgA is the main antibody that protects the mucous membranes from infection, from parasites, bacteria, viruses, toxins, and food antigens.
But we also have to be aware many people are allergic to whey and may not realize that some of the formulations they're using are causing an exacerbation of their mucus formation, their allergies. So it's not that everyone can use a whey product.
That's true. Yes, that's true. In addition to those products, specific diets are often helpful. For instance, a low iron diet can help to starve the toxic bacteria. If someone has yeast overgrowth, they should restrict the yeast food supply, which is sugar, alcohol, fermented foods. And then in addition to these approaches, we also need to recolonize the intestinal tract with beneficial bacteria. The beneficial bacteria produce natural antibiotics that help to kill off toxic organisms. And they also physically displace the toxic organisms. There's only so much space, only so much surface area available on the intestinal wall for different organisms to adhere to and colonize. And if the beneficial bacteria are occupying space on the intestinal wall, then toxic organisms will pass through the body and out in the feces. And then other approaches that are important are making sure the immune system is functioning properly. And
I just want to interject a different thought here, Joseph, and ask you to explore it in depth. People don't understand the physiology of the intestine, how food actually gets broken down and digested. They look at it as a hollow tube, and during the transit time, the food will go from the stomach, where is kind of a chewed up mess called a bolus, into kind of a semi-soup thick, almost a stew consistency when it enters through the pyloric sphincter into the intestine. Once in there, in this kind of a, depending upon how much acid they had in the stomach, depending upon how well they chewed the food, depending upon whether it was raw and has a lot of fiber or cooked, or juices, explain to the audience in depth how all this gets intermixed and then the nutrients gets absorbed from the intestine into the bloodstream, and then goes through the liver for synthesis. And if you give it that in depth, I think they'll better appreciate why keeping that intestine clean and balanced and its pH and its bacterial levels is so important.
Right. Well, I think we should start with the cephalic stage of digestion.
And just speak up a little closer to the telephone, please.
Sure. Before we even eat food, our mental state has an impact on what's going on in our gastrointestinal tract. About 20% of hydrochloric acid production within the stomach and pancreatic enzyme production is dependent upon our mental state before we even eat. So if we eat in a rush and we're stressed out, we're not going to start off on the right foot as far as digestion goes. We need to be relaxed and focusing on our food as we sit down to eat. Take time to smell the food. That increases the secretion of digestive enzymes. I recommend for people not to eat too much liquid with food. That can dilute the digestive juices. Make sure you chew your food thoroughly. The chewing process increases the surface area on the food to allow enzymes greater access to do their job of breaking the food down into smaller particles. And as the food passes into the stomach, the body releases hydrochloric acid and pepsin, which is a protein splitting enzyme. If we don't have adequate hydrochloric acid, the pepsin does not become activated and it is not effective. And as I mentioned before, hydrochloric acid insufficiency is a very, very common problem. And there's a few other minor enzymes produced in the stomach, but mostly the stomach is involved with protein digestion. Then as the food empties from the stomach in response to stimulation from the enteric local nervous system and also the body's autonomic nervous system, the pancreas is stimulated by the presence of hydrochloric acid within the duodenum to release its enzymes called trypsin, chymotrypsin, carboxypeptidase, lipase, amylase. All these different enzymes serve to digest protein, fat, and carbohydrate. And at the same time, the pancreas releases sodium bicarbonate and water, which mixes everything together and activates these enzymes to do their job of breaking down the chemical bonds within these macronutrients, within the protein, carbohydrate, and fat. And then the gallbladder follows by releasing bile. And bile is produced by the liver, stored in the gallbladder, and concentrated up to 15 to 20 times. So if you can hang on to your gallbladder, it's a good idea. It serves a purpose. Way too many people have their gallbladder removed when it's not necessary. And the bile serves to emulsify fat. It further breaks up the fat particles, allowing more surface area for the pancreatic enzymes to digest these fats. Then as the food travels along the small intestine, there are more enzymes produced along the intestinal wall that further break down small particles of fat, small protein chains, and small chains of sugars into much smaller molecules. For example, lactase splits the milk sugar lactose into glucose and galactose. And then these different nutrients are able to be transported across the intestinal wall into the bloodstream and then are passed through the liver. And the liver does a variety of things with these nutrients. It changes proteins, it shifts amino acids around, forms different types of proteins, manufactures different fats and cholesterol, stores glycogen, and then the nutrients after processing make their way throughout the body in the bloodstream and are used by the body for energy and repair.
Now, of course, one of the good parts of this and one of the justifications for juicing is that when you juice, you've already separated out the enzymes, the phytochemicals, the nutrients that the body can absorb, and since it's in a liquid form, much easier for it to absorb. And when you take your oils like flaxseed oil or olive oil, you don't have to have all that bile because it's not breaking down something like chicken or the marbling of meat. So it eases the digestive process.
Uh-huh.
Let's go on to talk about the different types of bacteria that we can put into our body, and the good and the bad bacteria.
Okay, presently, I don't think there's any adequate way to fully assess the different strains of bacteria within the intestinal tract, what's actually present there. There's some tests that can be done from stool samples to give us some idea. We can count the number of good bacteria. The Lactobacillus acidophilus and Bifidobacteria are the two strains of bacteria I feel should be considered for supplementation. And then we can also check for potentially toxic strains of bacteria, such as Pseudomonas or Klebsiella. Pseudomonas is often ingested from contaminated drinking water, from bottled drinking water. Other ways to assess the state of gastrointestinal balance is through urinalysis. From urine, we can measure metabolites of these different organisms and see if we have metabolites from toxic bacteria such as Clostridium difficile, which results after antibiotic usage, or if we have signs of metabolites from parasites such as Giardia or from yeasts. Again, the bacteria that should be considered for supplementation, I believe, are Bifidobacteria and Lactobacillus acidophilus. These bacteria produce a number of beneficial effects. They produce some of our vitamins, vitamin K, some of the B vitamins. They produce natural antibiotics to kill off toxic organisms. They stimulate the immune system. And in choosing a strain of bacteria for supplementation, you have to be very careful. This is one nutritional product that is very, very, very poor quality control. There was a study done in 1990, published in the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, that examined 12 different brands of Acidophilus, and only two of these brands were found to have any Acidophilus at all, and the amount they contained wasn't enough to do anything. So we have to be very careful with Acidophilus. First of all, a supplement of Acidophilus should be in powder form. If we use gel caps consist of 7% moisture, which starts the bacteria into their growth cycle, and this decreases the shelf life. And this is also true of plastic containers, so the powder should be in a glass bottle. Tablets are no good because tablets require heat and pressure, which kill the acidophilus. Then the product should be refrigerated. If acidophilus is left at room temperature, within 30 days, it's all dead. Another thing that's very amazing is that only 10% of the products sold contain human strains of acidophilus. And if we use a non-human strain of acidophilus, the body produces antibodies to it and kills it off within 3 weeks. So it doesn't have any lasting effect. Next, the acidophilus should be bile resistant. It needs to be able to pass through the intestine where the bile is and resist destruction by bile acid. And the acidophilus must be able to adhere to the intestinal wall and colonize. It's interesting that yogurt also contains non-human strains of acidophilus, and so it does not colonize either. Only a few strains have been proven to. And based on these criteria, the strain of acidophilus I recommend is the NCFM strain, which is available through a company called Metagenics.
Why don't we look at the role that stress plays on digestion?
Okay, stress affects digestion in a number of ways. Before I was speaking about secretory IgA, that's the main antibody that protects the mucous membranes, the genitourinary tract, the lungs, and the gastrointestinal tract from infection. It helps to protect against food antigens, viruses, bacteria, parasites, yeast. And under stress, the immune system weakens. We test routinely for stress hormones from saliva samples and for the secretory IgA levels, both in saliva samples and stool samples. And it's very common for us to see reduced secretory IgA. If the body's immune system is compromised, then we're going to be more easily infected with parasites, yeast, and toxic bacteria. Another effect of stress on the gastrointestinal tract is that it impairs digestive secretions, so it impairs digestion. It also decreases the protective mucus lining on the intestinal tract, and so we're more disposed to damage of the intestinal lining, and this includes ulceration. Stress also diverts blood flow away from the gastrointestinal tract. And when the blood flow returns to the gastrointestinal tract after a period of time, this often produces free radicals. The influx of oxygen all of a sudden results in free radical damage to the intestinal wall. And stress also causes a breakdown of the intestinal lining by converting the protein within it into glucose for fuel. And this often occurs when people don't eat frequently enough. If you go long periods of time without eating, your body mobilizes cortisol, which causes a breakdown in this intestinal lining. And this leads to all kinds of systemic conditions. Not only does it damage the gastrointestinal tract and produce local symptoms, but by breaking down the intestinal wall, there's an effect on the whole body. This is because the gastrointestinal wall serves two functions. It's a It allows for selective absorption of nutrients, and at the same time, it has to keep what's in the intestine out of the bloodstream, you know, things that shouldn't be in the bloodstream, toxic organisms and their metabolites. And under stress, when this barrier breaks down, then we have toxic organisms and their waste products passing into the bloodstream, taxing the liver and poisoning the rest of the body and producing virtually every degenerative disease known.
What? Thank you. I appreciate that answer, Joseph. In the time remaining, why don't you tell us about the problematic foods, the foods we simply should be careful of because they're going to cause some difficulty?
Okay. In my opinion, I think if you're eating whole foods, the foods you need to be aware of are really an individual thing. Of course, if you're eating sugar, table sugar, all kinds of refined sugars, refined carbohydrates, you're probably going to run into trouble. That depresses the immune system and also feeds toxic yeast. Also, alcohol is a big problem. Alcohol can cause gastritis and interfere with the production of hydrochloric acid. It kills the cells that produce the hydrochloric acid. Alcohol is another thing that contributes to the leaky gut syndrome I was referring to a minute ago with stress. Alcohol also contributes to that. Coffee is also a problem. Coffee stresses the stomach's ability to produce acid adequately. And talking about the most common food allergens, the ones that are containing grains, and in particular wheat, dairy products of all kind, foods containing yeast, citrus fruits, corn, peanuts, shellfish. Those are the most common allergens, but for a person to really determine which foods are a problem in their case, they need to go through an elimination diet. What you do is you avoid all the common allergens for a couple of weeks, and then you reintroduce one new food into your diet every 2 to 3 days and keep track of your symptoms. While you're in the elimination phase, you should be feeling much better. And once you start reintroducing problematic foods, you'll start to experience those troubles and symptoms.
Joseph, we're out of time. I appreciate you very much sharing these insights. If people would like more information, could you give us a number? Joseph Dobbs.